The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Good Samaritan laws shield people from prosecution when they call emergency services in the case of an overdose. But just because they're shielded from being charged and convicted, does that mean they're also shielded from being arrested? Now, I'll be blunt, I think that's a silly question. Obviously they should. But police in Saskatchewan, Canada, disagree. Thus, on January 14th, the Supreme Court of Canada hears the case of the Crown v. Wilson. Several organizations have filed to intervene in the case on the side of the defendant. The groups held a hearing January 13th to discuss the case and its implications. First, to explain what this case is about and the legal intervention these groups are making, here's DJ Larkin, Executive Director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition.
Tomorrow, January 14th, the Supreme Court of Canada will be asked to determine the future of the Good Samaritan Drug Overdose Act. The court's decision and its reasoning will have implications nationwide in the midst of a public health crisis. The Good Samaritan law was enacted in 2017 as part of Canada's public health approach to substance use. It prohibits criminal law sanction for simple drug possession and a number of other related offenses against people who call 911, who are bystanders, and who are experiencing a toxic drug medical emergency. The purpose of that law is clear: to prevent harm, to save lives, to encourage people not to use alone, and to call 911 in case of an emergency. So the appeal that will be heard tomorrow arises from a 2020 arrest based on a 911 call in Saskatchewan. A woman showed signs of drug toxicity. The people with her did what we hope anyone would do for a loved one in that circumstance. They called 911, provided CPR, and stayed on the scene. They trusted the protection afforded to them by the Good Samaritan law, and they did the right thing. Their action likely saved her life. Despite that, she and those who stayed with her were arrested for drug possession. Incident to that arrest, the individuals and vehicle were searched, leading to other criminal charges. And so now the question that the court will be asked to decide is, does the criminal code authorize the arrest of an individual at the scene of a drug overdose for the offense of simple drug possession, even if the individual may be ultimately immune from being charged or convicted with that offense? To answer this question, the court will need to consider the purpose of the law, the likelihood that the risk of being arrested at the scene of a drug-related medical emergency will cause people to delay or avoid calling 911 or encourage people to flee the scene, and to consider the outcomes of those decisions on the health and lives of people who are impacted. Our coalition of organizations will be appearing to offer an analytical path that is grounded in core public health principles, ones that will help ensure that this law can make good on its promised purpose. First, public health law exists to prevent not only death, but also harm, injury, and psychological trauma. Second, these laws need to be clear and easily understood. If anyone needing to take action in an emergency, they need to know the risk they face. You shouldn't need a law degree to understand what will happen if you call 911. And finally, courts are a place of thoughtful analysis and rigorous evidence. Judicial decisions need to resist adopting latent bias and need to interrogate assumptions made about people who use drugs and the impacts of drug law enforcement. So we offer these guiding principles as a structured way to determine the future of the Good Samaritan law to ensure that people, like the folks arrested that day in Saskatchewan, will call 911 and will help save a life.
That was DJ Larkin, Executive Director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, speaking at a briefing held January 13th to discuss the case of the Crown v. Wilson, which ultimately asks the question of whether police should respect the spirit of the Good Samaritan anti-overdose laws. Now here's Corey Ranger, president of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association.
At least 49,105 people have died in Canada from drug poisoning since 2016. The primary driver of these deaths is a toxic, unpredictable, and unregulated drug supply contaminated with unwanted adulterants, variable concentrations of fentanyl and its analogs, and non-opioid sedatives like animal tranquilizers. These deaths share a commonality. Most of them occurred when the person was alone. We know that isolation plus a toxic drug supply is a recipe for preventable death and harms. The take-home naloxone program has been one of the most impactful interventions in responding to the public health emergency of overdose. As a nurse, I've taught hundreds of people how to prevent, recognize, and respond to opioid overdose using naloxone since the onset of this crisis. When my colleagues and I do naloxone training, we tell people that you must stay with the person who overdosed, that leaving them behind is a risk for death, and that the Good Samaritan laws will protect you and them if the police arrive. In public restrooms, clinics, and community centers across the country, there are posters from health authorities that say, suspect an overdose, call 911, and stay with the person. The Good Samaritan laws will protect you. If those posters have to change, if our education has to change, if it becomes something like, suspect an overdose, call 911, and stay with the person, the Good Samaritan laws might protect you, then we'll see a lot more people abandoned at the scene of an overdose. And that means more preventable harm. Ensuring our Good Samaritan laws are effective in preventing harm is why the HRNA chose to intervene in this case. Any intervention or any interpretation of these laws that reduces clarity will result in delays in resuscitation. That means not only a heightened risk for death, but also for preventable brain injury. In BC, people who have had one or more drug toxicity events were 15.3 times more likely to have encephalopathy or non-traumatic brain injury. Timely intervention, particularly naloxone administration and rescue breathing, is critical in reducing risk of brain injury. Our members represent expert nurses working street outreach, community, mental health, and substance use across this country. Many of them, myself included, know the feeling of finding someone deceased and alone far too late for resuscitation. The experience of moral distress and moral injury is devastating. If we want fewer workers finding people dead in tents, alleyways, public restrooms, then we must not compromise on the Good Samaritan provision. This is about protecting the health and safety of everyone.
That was Corey Ranger, president of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association, speaking at a briefing held January 13th to discuss the case of the Crown v. Wilson. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's get back to that briefing held by the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition and other interveners in a case before the Supreme Court of Canada, Crown v. Paul Eric Wilson. Here's Louis Letellier de Saint-Joux. He's a health law lawyer, also president of the Association of Addiction Workers of Quebec.
Merci, Jessica. Bonjour à tous.
Thank you, Jessica. Hello, everyone. The role of AIDQ within this coalition, drawn from its mission to support, develop, and promote best practices, interventions related to addictions and substance use. We work regularly with frontline workers and people who have firsthand experience of substance use. We collaborate very closely with intervention workers, individuals within public health, and people working within public safety. One thing that is very clear for us that when it is time to interact with situations related to simple possession, the idea of doubt and confidence are very fragile. We have seen that fears around being arrested when calling 911 has a strong negative impact. When we save someone's life, Good Samaritan laws must be simple, fully predictable in terms of people's ability to understand it and in its application. An interpretation that has followed from our experience with Good Samaritan laws is very clear. And the only interpretation that makes sense is that it allow for people to save lives, to take a public health approach and not an approach of criminalization. I want to remind you that a decision was made in Quebec in 2023, which reversed an accusation of drug possession when the Good Samaritan law was meant to be applied. In modifying the Canadian Act on certain substances, the Canadian government made it clear that it wanted to significantly reduce fears around calling 911 in incidences of an overdose. In taking this action, the government was giving frontline workers a significant new tool in order to prevent and intervene in crisis situations. The role and responsibility of international workers is a central concern for this law. They have to be reassured. You need to be able to inform people who use drugs and those close to them, not just around the use of substances, but how they can behave in order to reduce the negative impacts of the use of psychoactive substances. Clarity is crucial, and it is what will allow intervention efforts to have a real impact during a crisis that is still underway at a national level. Thank you.
That was Louis Letellier de Saint-Just, president of the Association of Addiction Workers of Quebec, speaking at a briefing held January 13th to discuss the case of the Crown v. Wilson. Now, here's attorney Maxime Bédard.
I want to take a few minutes to hopefully clarify the important role of an intervener before the Supreme Court of Canada. As you may know, the vast majority of cases heard by the Supreme Court come in the form of a legal dispute between two parties. In the case at bar, these two parties are the government and Mr. Wilson. And for any such dispute, the primary role of the Supreme Court is to answer the legal questions necessary to determine which party should win. But as you can imagine, because the Supreme Court's decisions are binding on all other courts in the country, the answer to these questions will almost always impact individuals and groups of individuals beyond the specific parties to the case. And in addition to that, the methodology used by the Supreme Court to answer these questions, combined with any other statements the court may make in the process, can inform how other courts across Canada will answer similar questions in the future. It is therefore critical that the Supreme Court not only gets the answers right, but also that the court's reasoning process in getting to these answers, ultimately this will take the form of a written decision, that will help push the law in the right direction. But oftentimes, the initial parties to a case simply do not have all the knowledge and expertise required to give the court the necessary tools to reason through the many nuances of a case. And this is where the interveners come into play. The role of an intervener is thus to provide their own unique perspective on the questions at issue based on their expertise and practical experience. The goal of an intervention is to help the Supreme Court decide these questions in a way that is responsive to the impacts of its decision beyond the initial parties to a case. But what an intervener cannot do, unfortunately, is try to expand the scope of the case by asking the court to answer additional questions beyond those posed by the initial parties. So with all that in mind, in our case, the primary question that the Supreme Court is asked to decide is whether or not the police can legally arrest a person for simple possession at the scene of an overdose. And in the course of answering this question, we believe the court may well have to wrestle with the benefits and disadvantages, if there are any, of precluding arrests at the scene of an overdose. And that is precisely where our intervention lies. We aim to provide the Supreme Court with additional guidance regarding the full scope of the impacts its decision will ultimately have on public health and public safety.
That was Maxime Bédard, a lawyer with Daniel Brown Law, LLP, speaking at a briefing held January 13th to discuss the case of the Crown v. Wilson. Here again is DJ Larkin, Executive Director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition.
Courts make decisions based on evidence, law, and thoughtful analysis. They are not activists, and they do not make decisions lightly. Courts need both analytical tools and robust evidence. And unfortunately, when those are absent, just like for any of us, courts can unknowingly adopt prejudices and assumptions into decision-making, and they may not be supported by evidence. The work of the courts is even more difficult in a controversial context like drug policy. Public discourse around the unregulated drug crisis is complex. It can be hard for the public to know what information is well-founded and what is based in stigma and misinformation. And the same is true in the courtroom. We do not say this lightly. I'd be happy to point you to a 2024 academic analysis of 129 criminal law decisions in Canada that finds that moralizing language, including words and tropes that cannot be interpreted as purely impartial, are entrenched and normalized in judicial decision-making. So we will be asking the court to adopt an analysis that questions statements that we often see as common sense, but that may not be supported by evidence. And in this case, those assumptions have grave potential to cause irreparable harm. Central to this appeal, like you've heard, is the need to test the assumption that arresting, searching, or seizing small amounts of drugs from people at the scene of a drug-related medical emergency benefits public safety, and to test the assumption that the risk of arrest will not discourage people from calling 911. There is significant analysis showing a correlation between drug seizures and subsequent increased risk of overdose. And there is analysis showing that law enforcement measures, even those short of formal criminal conviction, can cause people to delay or avoiding calling for help. And so, as you've heard, that delay of even minutes can have dire consequences. So we are asking the court to adopt an analysis that questions the assumptions we make, that carefully considers where evidence is lacking or where statements are based in moral judgment, not evidence and sound reasoning. In the midst of a national crisis that claims more than 20 lives a day and causes more preventable and life-altering injuries, the Good Samaritan law can help protect us and our loved ones. But to do so, the law must be interpreted to ensure that it prevents harm and injury as best it can, that it is simple to understand for all members of the public, and that its implementation is based on evidence, not assumptions, not prejudice. We are looking forward to the opportunity to be heard. We'd be happy to answer your questions here today. The outcome of this appeal will impact the lives and safety of us and of our loved ones across this country.
That was DJ Larkin, Executive Director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, speaking at a briefing held January 13th to discuss the case of the Crown v. Wilson, which ultimately asked the question of whether police should respect the spirit of Good Samaritan anti-overdose laws. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, they took time for questions at this briefing. Let's hear some of those. Again, the speakers are Attorney DJ Larkin, Executive Director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition; Corey Ranger, President of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association; Attorney Louis Letellier de Saint-Joux, President of the Association of Addiction Workers of Quebec; and Attorney Maxime Bedard with Daniel Brown Law, LLP. The moderator is Jessica Hannon with the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition.
DJ or Maxime, would you be able to speak a little bit to the specific case in Saskatchewan and what happened with Mr. Wilson and what the Crown is arguing for in this case?
I'm happy to take this one as well. So what happened in Saskatchewan is that a group of people were, I assume they used drugs, and then they had to call 911 because one of their friends was overdosing. And what happened is when the police arrived at the scene, what they saw was evidence of drug possession immediately, which naturally can occur at the scene of an overdose. But disregarding whether or not they knew about the Good Samaritan Act, they decided that the first thing they were going to do was arrest those people for simple possession. And that ultimately gave them the power to search their person and search their car. And in doing these search, they found evidence of other crimes, like evidence of firearms and larger quantities of drugs. And that's relevant because at the end of the day, the law is quite clear that you cannot charge someone for simple possession. And that's not what the police did ultimately in Saskatchewan. But what they did is they used the arrest for simple possession as a means to search these people to find evidence of other crimes. And they ultimately got charged with these crimes. And so part of our intervention is to say that using an arrest for simple possession as a means to search will discourage people from calling 911. And it's just plainly contrary to the purpose of the Good Samaritan Act.
If it's okay, I'll just jump in. One further thing to what Maxime is saying. When you are calling 911 for medical support because of a toxic drug medical emergency, you are already in a situation where there will be an assumption that you're essentially admitting to something that is criminalized. Because you had to call 911 for medical assistance, that means quite likely someone did or does possess a controlled substance. So that's why it is ever more important to make it clear that you can call 911 for medical help and you will be safe in doing so. It is very rare that when someone calls 911, it essentially means that whoever answers that call is already walking in, assuming that there may be evidence of a crime there. These types of calls need to be responded to as medical emergencies, because that is what they are. This law protects people from criminal sanction, from conviction for drug possession. And so that risk is supposed to be off the table. The reason that risk is supposed to be off the table is so that people will call without having that second thought of what could happen to me. Will I get arrested? Will I end up in court if I call to help somebody?
I have a question for DJ about the role of assumptions in court cases. So the question is, DJ, you spoke about assumptions and ensuring the court is going to make decisions based on evidence. What assumptions are you anticipating they might make? And what are you hoping to tell them?
Sure. So one assumption that we often see adopted in our reasoning is the assumption that drug possession, simple drug possession by itself, is the primary public safety risk that needs to be addressed. And that law enforcement, like taking away drugs or arresting somebody, has a positive outcome. That is actually, that seems like common sense because of the criminal law has told us that that seems like common sense, but it's not supported by the evidence. The primary safety issue we are facing is the unregulated drug supply. It is the risk of people dying and being injured. And there is very good evidence showing a correlation between seizing drugs and arresting people and an increased risk of overdose, of toxic drug medical emergency. And so even that core assumption is something that we see very often in the judicial system. And courts need the analytical tools to question that and to actually say, I don't know if it's true. And in relation to this law that has a goal of public health and protecting public health, how do we interpret this law to make sure it can do that? And how do we identify what the key issues are that need to be addressed when someone calls 911? And the key issue is save a person's life, prevent injury, and encourage people to stay on the scene. So there's a lot of other assumptions that can arise, but the core one here is interrogate the assumption that law enforcement is going to help in this circumstance. Interrogate the assumption that that interaction with police, even if it isn't a formal charge, ask yourself, will that stop someone from calling 911 next time?
Recognizing the time here, I'm wondering if, and maybe this is a question for Maxime, if you could speak a little bit to kind of what happens next. When is the intervention itself? What is the timeline that we expect for a decision on this case? I'll go to Maxime for that one.
Yes, of course. So the hearing is tomorrow. The way it's going to work is both the appellant and the respondent, so the two main parties, will have 1 hour to make their oral submissions each, and then it'll be time for the interveners. In this case, there's six of us. So six different organizations that are intervening, bringing forward their own perspective on the issue. And so we'll be one of the six. We'll have a few minutes, in this case 5 minutes, to make submissions about what DJ mentioned, the importance of clarity, challenging unsupported assumptions, and the like. And hopefully we'll get questions. There'll be likely a panel of 9 judges interested in the case, and so we're ready to respond to their questions. And then what will happen afterwards is the judges will retire, and they will decide among themselves who's in favor of the appellant's position, who's in favor of the respondent's position, and let's say they're unanimous, they'll appoint someone to write the decision. Then judges will go back and forth, providing comments, and once the decision is ready to be released, then we'll know exactly what the court thinks of this case. and hopefully we get a judgment that incorporates some of the core principles we've put forward. And we can expect a judgment. It can vary widely, but I'd say it takes around 6 months to receive such a judgment.
Great. Thank you, Maxime. And just as a final question, I'll put this to Corey or DJ or Louis, whoever would like to speak, or maybe multiple. What do you hope to see happen next? What are you hoping for as a result of this?
What we're hoping for is quite simple, and that is that there is no reinterpretation of the Good Samaritan laws that leads to confusion, that adds to complexity, that causes someone to pause before dialing 911, that brings us back to the days where people would be found with naloxone administered but abandoned at the scene and in the recovery position, and most certainly at a higher risk for a brain injury. And so we're looking to see this law protected and actually, you know, as clear as possible, so that we can continue to provide good public health messaging, so that we can continue to encourage people to keep each other safe and to call 911 and to wait until first responders arrive.
En ce qui nous concerne, ce sera une décision qui sera attendue avec impatience.
For us, obviously, it's a decision that we're going to be waiting for impatiently. We hope that the Supreme Court will be able to make a decision quickly, because it will have an impact on how support workers and drug users behave. We will be able to act within our organizations, public organizations, community organizations, and in collaboration with public health and public safety organizations to ensure that the law is properly applied. So we need to make sure that this law has been clarified, that its objectives are well understood, that its application is well understood. For us, we agree on what it should be doing, and we feel that it needs to be confirmed and repeated at this level by the Supreme Court.
DJ, any final thoughts?
I'll just say, as a policy organization, we need a national level action. The Supreme Court of Canada is the court that will have national impact in its decisions. So we are hoping for them to provide a guiding light to help judges make decisions and understand what is a public health law and how do I interpret it to make sure that it works. The court has the opportunity to decide this case in a way that provides a beacon for other courts so that we can prevent harm, so that we can save the lives of our loved ones and our community members. And we hope to have the opportunity to, give them a framework that we think would be helpful to that.
You just heard DJ Larkin, Executive Director of the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, Corey Ranger, President of the Harm Reduction Nurses Association, Louis Letellier de Saint-Joux, President of the Association of Addiction Workers of Quebec, Maxime Bedard, a lawyer with Daniel Brown Law, LLP, and Jessica Hannon with the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition. They took part in a briefing on legal interventions filed in the case of the Crown v. Wilson, which the Supreme Court of Canada hears on January 14th. The question before the court is whether Good Samaritan laws, which were enacted in order to make it possible for people to phone emergency services in the case of overdose without fear of being charged and prosecuted for saving a life, also prevent police from making an arrest. It's a developing story. When there's more news, we'll bring it to you. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.